Welcome to our most recent podcast series, Collective Intelligence. At a moment when the shape of work is being redrawn, we seek to explore the magic that happens when groups perform at more than the sum of their parts. A theme we researched extensively in our book, The Social Brain, The Psychology of Successful Groups.
Hi, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. James Mountford to our episode of Collective Intelligence. James has spent a lifetime in healthcare, and I'm so excited about our conversation today, James, because not only are you editor-in-chief of the BMJ Leader, which is a journal that focuses on helping people think about leading and managing today's health systems around the world, but you also played a seminal role in setting up the Nightingale Field Hospital in London, which we'll talk about in a moment. You were really around helping patient and staff safety, the quality of care, and learning in how to think about working in the hospital. James, it was wonderful. I've met you on several occasions and have always been absolutely fascinated with our conversations about your learning of kindness in the healthcare sector and also your leadership expertise in thinking in a very creative and expansive way about leading health and some of the challenges. So looking forward to our conversation. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Sam. It's been wonderful getting to know you over the last year or so, and I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
James, I know COVID seems like so long ago. I mean, it's difficult to imagine that was really 5 years ago, half a decade ago. But there are some real leadership lessons that we can still draw from that huge experiment about how to make things work, even in the most trying of circumstances. Can I begin there and just ask from you, some of your leadership lessons that you took from leading the Nightingale Project, which was a massive endeavor and incredibly important to the UK at that moment.
Absolutely. And Sam, I mean, I look back on this as if it was simultaneously yesterday and a very, very long time ago, which is a slightly curious thing. And I think as we talk about this, it's worth if we can all think back to the moment that our country's locked down, and just think about what we knew and didn't know then and how we were feeling. So in the work that we're going to talk about, which in my case was stopping running improvement and organizational change at the Royal Free Hospital, a big teaching hospital in North London, and moving to a shed, a very large shed, a conference center called the Excel in East London, to try quickly to build an intensive care unit there. I used to come home and open the door, and I'd be presented with a plastic box, and into that would go all my clothes, and I would go down and have a shower because, as we used to joke, I was working in COVID Central, and then I'd meet the family. So we didn't know at that time that to relatively healthy people, particularly to children, COVID wasn't generally terribly harmful, for example. And so I just think, framing looking forwards rather than in the light of what we know is helpful. And the other thing I would say, and I absolutely don't want in any way to diminish the pain and the loss and the upheavals that everybody suffered, but I do think in some ways we showed the best of us. And we did things that we couldn't normally do, and we learned things that offer a bit of light and lessons for normality. So yeah. I think we'll talk about that a bit.
Yeah, and I think in some senses, James, it was a huge experiment, really, because as you say, it wasn't particularly well predicted. People didn't have plans, and we certainly didn't imagine the impact that it would have. So yeah, I mean, we almost had to kind of learn on the job, so to speak. And I think therein lay the sort of real leadership moments, as the ancients call it, the kairos happened at that moment. We had to bring everything into play. I'd love to hear how you thought about that when it all started and happened.
Yeah. So pretty much within the space of a morning, I went from my frame of reference having been shifting a team that was, as I say, focusing on embedding continuous quality improvement into a hospital of 12,000 people across multiple sites to transforming that, suspending what we normally did, trying to support our staff virtually. And that transition had been effectively the last 10 days, sitting at home at my desk thinking, oh my God, you know, what is this thing and how on earth am I going to do a good job in it? And I got a call from a chap called Alan McGlennon, who became the medical director of the Nightingale London, and he outlined the concept. I had had no idea that this was in train. It had been, I think, about 48 hours planning at that time. And I can remember very clearly sitting at my desk, doing some random Googling about field hospitals, calling a friend who'd been in the army. But most of all, and I still have the piece of paper, and I hope I never lose it, writing down the names of some people who I thought if we could get them on the bus, then the bus could drive. And out of five names, we managed to get four of them. I'd say by lunchtime, and I knew that they could come by lunchtime because many people's normal lives were stopping. And this was a fire that many people ran to, which was wonderful in itself. And by lunchtime, I'd gone from feeling sick to feeling very, very challenged but excited. And you know, just imagine. Let me describe what happened the next day, perhaps when I arrived at the Excel Center. So the vast concourses of this conference center, maybe a quarter of a mile long, it has two light railway stations, one at each end. It's that big. And it was completely empty, except for many electricians and others who were drilling to install more power, basically. And so this is really a story about our happiness is determined by our frame of reference. So I looked at this and thought, oh my goodness, you know, there's nothing here. There's nothing that I'm familiar with. There's no equipment, there's people. One of the wonderful things about this enterprise was working with the military, the British Army and the Royal Engineers. They had a very different view. They were, it's warm, it's dry, there's a roof, no one's shooting at us, let's crack on.
Gosh. I mean, James, it's interesting that you managed to gather a group of people so quickly and so keen to be involved. And I think there's something about the social capital that you'd built up over many, many years to be able to do that effectively. And when we talk about collective intelligence, of course, what we're referring to is being able to bring the best people into play and work as a group. And I'm just curious about when you thought about the people to bring into the project, you know, what led you to kind of identifying those particular people? What were you looking for? What were the sort of leadership characteristics or sort of elements that they displayed yeah. that you thought would make this work?
So healthcare in London is a small village, really. And I think there's a lot of social capital across it, often very positive. And I can remember over the first 72 hours trying to get up and running, thinking, oh, you know, we had a workforce thing. Wouldn't it be fantastic if Sandy Druitt was here? And then I turned around and she's there. Or for pharmacy, the guy called Jat Harshawal, and he was there. I mean, it was uncanny. But in terms of trying to build what became the quality and learning team, we called it, and really that concept of continuous learning from our own daily or even minute by minute experience is absolutely central to this story. It was people who really had, if you like, expertise in the domain. But two other things, which I think are even more important, they were people who I felt I really trusted and knew. I could, you know, laugh and cry with them, being vulnerable. We'd been through a lot together. We were, if you like, friends as well as old colleagues. I wasn't working with any of them at that particular moment directly. But the other thing I think is just that they're the sort of people who get on with things, who ride with bumps, who relish uncertainty. So it's the sort of people whose choice under pressure is to be positive.
How interesting. And James, I mean, it's really interesting because it was such a pressure time for everybody, and especially when you're running or leading a project of this scale and stepping into absolutely unknown territory. What was your own, how did you lead yourself, so to speak? How did you become your best leader in that circumstance? Did you have any ways or means that you did that deliberately?
Very good question, Sam. So I think I want to give credit there to Alan and others, Eamon Sullivan, who was the chief nurse, Natalie Forrest, who was in overall charge. And they were the sort of people who set absolutely the right tone. Here it was, really. We've got a really clear purpose and mission. We need to protect London. We need to have a mortality that is equivalent to that of the base hospitals. We need to get up and running quickly, and we need to look after our staff. And everything else flowed from that. Now, in a way, what we have here is a much easier situation in a pandemic, because we're trying to do those very few things, and running a full health system is infinitely more complex. But I do wonder if the learning, and perhaps we'll talk more about this, is whether each team can divide responsibilities in their area and determine what really is it that we are here to do, and how are we going to know if we're doing a good job, and then to be very, very clear across themselves how they fit into a bigger whole, but what their purpose is. And I would say there's a real difference here between ownership and buy-in. So buy-in is you're asking me to do something, but I don't really believe it. I'd rather do something else. And ownership is I'm absolutely behind this. And I know that I'll push myself, but I also know that I'll make mistakes, and I know that those mistakes are going to be treated as learning rather than approached with fear. So, you know, this clarity, psychological safety is what we call it now, I guess. But also, and very importantly, that it sounds silly to say now, but it was the virus that was setting the timescale, not our traditional processes, our governance mechanisms, etc. So that's how we stood up in less than 3 weeks to take our first patients. You know, when in normal times, let's say the NHS isn't necessarily known for moving fast managerially.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very interesting. Of course, as you say, the virus set the pace, but you mentioned the word tone, and it sounds like that group set the tone, which is something that is so difficult to measure. I mean, we don't have words to measure tone necessarily, but of course it leads everything, really. Yeah. And it begins. Yeah. So I'm curious about if you can expand a little bit about when you say tone, what do you mean?
Okay. So let me give you two elements to that. So the first is just the physical way we were working. So think about, I don't know, maybe it was 100, 150 people who were essentially building this thing. And there was a much larger staff who were, you know, then providing the care. And we were in a big work stream was recruiting those people. We worked essentially it didn't start off like this. We were in four or five rooms, but we put ourselves all in one room. So the transaction costs of interacting with another team were extremely low. You literally just walked over to their table. And then at 4 o'clock every day, we had this effectively a stand-up meeting where we'd go around. There was, I don't know, 15 teams, and it was run in rotation by Alan and Eamon and Natalie. And another guy, a wonderful cardiologist from Barts called Richard Schilling. And each table would do three quick report outs. They would say, here are the main things we've been working on. This is the progress we've made, and this is the help we need from you. And that meeting would run from 4 to 5 every day, sometimes 7 days a week. So just highly, highly socialized. And I hadn't really thought of this, but I reckon we were about Dunbar's number for the purposes of this podcast in that. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that if ever there was a time when it was legitimate in healthcare to say, we do not know what we are doing, this was it, right? We had a novel work environment. We had completely novel stuff. Some of the people in the clinical area were not people who were normally in clinical areas, right? And we were working with people from many, many different sources. So we had, for example, staff support provided by furloughed airline cabin crew. They weren't in the clinical area. And most of all, we had a novel disease. And so I think one of our biggest learnings could be about being more honest and ready to say when we don't know, because that's how you keep safe. So in a sense, it was the extreme novelty of the situation combined with a need to learn really fast. I mean, you know, it would be literally like people would scan social media, call their mates in Madrid and Milan to find out what was going on. I mean, this is highly, highly odd. And we thought we were treating one disease, a lung disease called ARDS, acute respiratory distress. And then it turned out we were treating a rather different disease. And we learned that as we were building the hospital. So I think above all, it was those two things that our most senior leadership was brilliant at setting the tone on.
I mean, that's such a wonderful articulation. And you've put something else in there, which I think in all our research that we've done over many years around sort of good leadership and how leaders sort of thrive and when they're brilliant at what they do, is that there's a real edge of learning in it. Is we essentially become quite bored quite quickly. So there's a kind of novelty when there's something that you kind of really having to noodle together as a group of people. There's something so energizing about that, even as it feels very difficult at that time. And I have read your article in the Harvard Business Review is really around some of these leadership lessons. And I wonder if there's anything else that you've taken some time to reflect on many years later to say, actually, there was also this other piece that I've come to realize was sort of gold dust.
Yeah. So I think we had in that article, it was called something like 10 leadership lessons. And the last one we called Be There, which really means be visible. Like if there's nothing else you can do for your teams, just go and be among them, be available to them, listen to them. A couple of other things that are really striking to me. So the first was categorizing the nature of the learning and the changes that we needed to make. And we quickly developed this very simple, I mean, it sounds absurdly simplistic, framework of fix, improve, and change or discover. So fix, for example, when the hospital opened, we discovered that people were sitting on the floor to write the notes on the charts. So one thing you've got in a conference center is loads of chairs. So literally on the same shift, we could get chairs in so that people could be a little bit more comfortable. When you were putting the protective equipment on, it was helpful to be able to see whether your mask fitted and stuff. So we could quickly fit some mirrors in the little rooms where people put their stuff on. So a fix is just something that is almost one step to making the lives better of the people who are doing the work. And you just do it. And I think it's sad that so often we don't see those fixes or we don't act on them in normal times. And so people just get used to, it's almost like a learned helplessness that nothing gets fixed, right? So that's the first one. Then improve, which is, if you like, my bread and butter. I mean, that's what I'd spent 10 years, 15 doing before this. So that's the focused improvement of something that you know basically how you need to do it. And there's a nice example of that was that the putting on of the PPE, we'd constructed these little rooms. It turned out they were too small, so that was moved out into the concourse. And the key thing about that, I really wish I had a video of it. The if you like, the leadership of the hospital didn't direct that. That just emerged, and we saw one day that that's how it was being done, right? That people get their kid on in the concourse, and then they'd move for the check in what had been the changing room. And then the last category, this change or discover, was for things like, well, how you would provide feeding support. So we this was a novel disease, and so we started with a feeding regime that you'd use for this respiratory distress with a patient. Remember, all the patients are anaesthetized and the tubes in their throats, as you have in an intensive care unit. But that was doing funny things, and one of the dietitians spotted this and had some ideas which came up at this 4 o'clock meeting about how to change the feeding regime from the standard Barts Health ARDS feed protocol. And I think that's another lesson which we call defer to expertise. So Danny was her name. I still remember it. I mean, she was, if you like, somewhere down the org chart. In a normal world, she wouldn't be necessarily or even likely to get into the meetings where these things are decided. But actually, it was her knowledge that really mattered. So we said to her, okay, who do you need on your little task team? Will you report back tomorrow? And by the next 4 o'clock meeting, they'd been through two change cycles on their feeding. So, I and imagine for someone who really cares about their work, I mean, never mind that, you know, you're in a national emergency and trying to save lives, imagine how empowering that is. And imagine how the flip side, the disempowering, that you know, you I mean, I'll stereotype a bit, you know, you spot a problem, you send it upwards, you talk to your manager, it may or may not go to a committee that may or may not be meeting to its regular rhythm, and then it may have to escalate to another committee, and you know, you may or may not be invited to part of it, and then you may or may not find out what the decision is. So you know, deference to expertise and shortening the feedback cycle, and combined with this honesty about, you know, this isn't working, this is a big safety risk. But again, I think I'd ground all of that in, we were really clear about what we were doing, we were quite scared, but our desire to learn overcame our fear of looking stupid.
Yeah, I mean, what a wonderful way of articulating that. And absolutely, I mean, we seem to be in a moment where we don't defer to expertise. We do the opposite, in fact. I mean, everyone's an expert if they can go and chat GPT or Google something. But actually, people who've really lived through these experiences, you know, gathering that wisdom, I think is something that one has to deliberately do. Otherwise, it just gets pushed to the edge, which is unhelpful. James, one other thing, and I really am curious about your kind of focus on kindness and how kindness has really threaded through your work, is that it sounds, you know, the building of these strong relationships, it sounds like the size of the groups or the teams you're working with really allowed that sort of close connection. And you know that we've written a lot about that in our book, The Social Brain, is how the size of groups really matter in terms of pro-social behavior and building levels of trust. And I'm just curious about this idea of kindness. How do you scale up kindness beyond the kind of small groups that we enjoy working with, that we kind of spend time with? How do we make this a movement?
So just as we move to that, and I hadn't thought about this until your question just now, Sam, but I think within this overall, just one last word on the Nightingale, within this overall Dunbar's number of people stewarding and building the place, we worked in teams of effectively 6 to 10, with that kind of tightness. And he'd love to say that that was by design. I'm not sure it was, but I darn well think it worked. So that's Wonderful things about these sorts of conversations is the things we learn about our own experience that we thought we knew quite well. Okay, so kindness. So let me just try and orientate it. I mean, most of my work has been in healthcare and education, so that's where I've, if you like, explored this. But I don't think what I'm going to say is in any way unique to healthcare. I think it's more general to humanity, but I mean certainly in the societies that I know. So I'm going to try and let me in a sense give a headline about where I'd like to go. So I think we need to have a very clear and direct confrontation of this view that kindness is soft. And if you can't be tough on the problem, then you're kind to the people. I think that is 180 degrees wrong. I also think that kindness is both an individual thing and a collective thing. And it is wrong to put the responsibility for being kind entirely onto the individual. I think that's a failure of systems and organizational leadership. And you could say, actually, quite abusive. I also think that we need to be clear about, without, if you like, overdoing definitions, but what kindness is and how it is different to, let's say, empathy and compassion, and indeed niceness. So this is what I think from having explored this with others in a, funnily enough, in a little steering group unofficially of around 10 people and then much wider communities. So we have a monthly kindness dialogue that generally about 60 or so people turn up to from a distribution list of 10 times that. So kind is an action, and kind is an action centered on your understanding of what the other person needs or wants to help them. And it's different to compassion because there's an implicit power dynamic in compassion. And linked to suffering. So if I'm compassionate to you, it implies that I've got more power than you and that you're suffering. So kindness can clearly be present and is important in situations of suffering, but not only in those situations. And it's also different to empathy, which is just a feeling. So empathy doesn't imply any action from me. So nice. I think nice is really quite instrumental. I think nice is about, if I'm really punchy on nice, is about me wanting you to like me. And it's quite vacuous, and it's more about me than you. So if you look up the dictionary definition of nice, it'll say something like, attractive, enjoyable, pleasant. I mean, not bad things. But the word derivation is quite interesting. I'm not a linguistic scholar, but nice comes from some Middle Ages French word nid, which means meh, vacuous, nothing. Whereas kind is linked to kin, family, togetherness. And of course, then there's a big question about, what's the circle to which I extend my kinship? And by the way, all of this is explained beautifully in a wonderful book about kindness in healthcare by a social scientist called John Ballot and Penelope Campling, which I highly recommend. So those are some of the, if you like, definitional foundations. And then I think that we get into this, and we could even talk, if we wanted to, about a business case for kindness. So there's a book, it's actually called Compassionomics, not Kindnessomics, by two American physicians. I think one's also a lawyer and an economist, Anthony Mazzarelli and Stephen Tresiak. And they, in this book, outline all the sorts of benefits to being kind to organizations' bottom line and to patients. So you would not be surprised to hear, I mean, loads of data in all sorts of settings across industries that employees who are treated well are more likely to treat their customers well. Therefore you'll have higher retention, lower recruitment costs, etc. But perhaps a bit more surprising in a healthcare context, and I think the evidence is quite good for this, that if teams, and here we have a bridge to psychological safety, which is that if teams feel able to speak up, that's a great defense against screwing up, and therefore you have lower medical error. That's absolutely embedded in, for example, the World Health Organization surgical checklist. But also, perhaps more curiously, that wounds heal faster after surgery for patients who rate their care as kind and compassionate. And therefore, their length of stay is lower. So the total cost of care and the, if you like, chances of something going wrong as a consequence of being in hospital is lower. So that's a very brief précis of a book, which is quite a good read. But I think it all mounts up to say, kindness is not soft. It's hard in two ways. It's not easy to do. It takes some skill and sometimes some courage. And it has important consequences, which are positive.
James, and I absolutely love your connection back to the word kinship, because it's easier, and we've written about this in our book. It's easier to be kind to those who we're close to and we know, and we have a good sense of who they are. And I guess what you're exploring in the work that you do is how do you extend that outside of the outer limits of our kin? Because I think that is the challenge, really. And of course, kindness is one of those things, once again, like tone is very difficult to measure in any form of objective way, which is why often it gets rejected as something that is a hard measure. But it is a very powerful and, as you say, very important way of being in the world, which has really huge impact. So, I mean, any tips to the listeners of this podcast, actually, about how to practice this kindness perhaps more? Or even to be conscious of being kind. I mean, what would that look like in very practical terms?
So I think awareness is the first step to action. And I mean, to an extent, perhaps what you should do depends on who you are. So if, for example, you are the chief executive or the director of finance of a hospital, and the funny thing is, I find in the smaller the conversation, the more people will tell you what they really think about this. So I think it, in our context in let's say the English NHS, I think it's quite hard for many people to go up on a public stage and talk about this, particularly when we have all the problems of staffing and errors and not enough money and not enough people. But because the dialogue that we've just been through, it might have taken us, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes to go through it, and most times you don't have that long for people's attention. But I think if you're in a senior leadership position, doing your very best to understand that this really is a platform technology to the results that you are being asked to give, as well as the right way to behave as a leader. That's what I would say. And there are ways of measuring it. I mean, let's not be shy about it. And it's slightly different, but we have in the English NHS the biggest, deepest, broadest, longest running survey of staff opinion, all of which would back up what I've been saying. It's called the NHS Staff Survey. And perhaps the greatest wonder is that we can't seem to act on it properly. I mean, do read what Michael West has written on this. If you are, let's go to the other end of the chain. If you are a student or a new healthcare assistant, I say talk to your colleagues and your patients about it. Don't accept that we are too financially pressured or too busy to be kind. The evidence suggests that you'll save yourself time. There's a almost like a sister piece to kindness, which is called What Matters to You. And I've been lucky enough to be part of, if you like, movements in both. just a word on that. It was yesterday, the 3rd of June, was World What Matters to You Day, first Tuesday of each year. And this is something that was born, well, with the New England Journal of Medicine. You know, how what greater authority than that article? But it got pioneered in, for example, Norway by Anders Vaage, in Scotland by Jen Rogers, two wonderful nurses who realized that what we do in healthcare is we often ask people, what's the matter with you? We're trained as deficit thinkers, you know, in a, what's the matter with you? You know, might be heard as, what's wrong with you? What's the problem with you? And that's important, of course. You need to get a diagnosis medically and treat it. But often equally important is the human edge, which is personal to someone's circumstances, of what matters to you. And English offers this beautiful double entendre of the word matter. You know, if you go to French or Norwegian, it doesn't quite work the same, but the concept is the same, and people get it. You know, so my medical training was all about, what is the matter with you? And we are the experts, and we will tell and sort. And I probably went into medical school a kinder person than I came out. You know, I wouldn't say that it's not universal, but certainly to be an impressive role model to James Mountford coming out of medical school, you did not have to be kind. I would say I'd learned that, and I think that's sad. You know, these things are really important. I mean, just a little story. You know, an elderly person who comes into hospital in an emergency, they may have never been out of their own bed for 40 years. This is a real example from my own background. And what was really bothering them was the fact that they didn't know if their dog was going to be fed or their plants watered. Now, in this particular case, they were, but if nobody tells them that they are, then they're sitting there with enough to worry about with, you know, this weird environment that we've put them into. And so again, you can quite quickly really make a difference to people by this twin focus. And lastly, I would say that you can apply this to your staff. And at the Royal Free Hospital, I mean, it's been fantastically picked up by a physio called Karen Turner and the chief nurse there, Rebecca Longmate, and others, to really try and legitimize for both inquiry to staff and patients, and build it into the governance system, this framing of what matters to you, as well as what's the matter with you.
Well, that is it's a wonderful place to end. I've got one question to ask before we close out, James. But I absolutely love this shift from what is the matter with you, to what matters to you. I mean, it's a small linguistic shift, but within it contains absolutely everything that is human. I want to ask you, James, in the world of AI, I mean, we're reading so much about artificial intelligence and how it's going to help us solve some of the world's most complex problems. Is there any sort of last message that you'd like to leave us with? You are a doctor of humans. You know, is there any sort of hopeful message that you can leave our listeners with as we move into an ever escalating world of artificial intelligence?
Well, I suspect most listeners will be familiar with the fear and trepidation at multiple levels that new technologies, you know, whether that's the horse or the internal combustion engine, the remote telephony and stuff. You know, I can remember being told at school that television was going to destroy my brain, and you know, these calculators that we were taking into class. I have never missed the use of a slide rule, or the fact that I missed learning how to use one. Maybe I don't know what I'm missing out on. So I guess I think, you know, maybe this is different for qualitative reasons, but I think what technologies can do is they can make us more able to focus on our humanity and what humans can uniquely and distinctively do. So, one of the things I'm exploring a lot at the moment is the use of AI in coaching, for example, executive business coaching. And the reality is that nearly everyone on the planet has no, not only do they not have any access to coaching, but they have no means of ever having any access to it. We've also got good evidence that people, and it might surprise people, it did surprise me instinctively that if we talk about talking therapies in a mental health context, that actually under certain circumstances, people like that machine interface. You know, it doesn't judge, it's always there. You know, literally like always there in the middle of the night if you want to use it. And technologies are changing quite quickly, and so imagine a world where you can choose and design your own therapist or coach to be in the, if you like, physical image and demeanor of someone who you want to interact with. So I just wonder whether we will look back on this and say our hope was not misplaced, that we allowed more people to flourish, and we removed from humans some mundane tasks that don't require a human. So, for example, if you're a doctor now, one of your most frustrating things is writing your note and writing letters afterwards. And actually, technology has probably worsened people's experience, both patients and doctors, and taken more time up until now. That's probably not universally fair, but I think that's pretty fair. There are now examples where we can have a natural consultation and sent to both of us, patient and a doctor or nurse, a pretty good summary without any time. Now that has to be good, doesn't it? I don't want to underplay the risks, you know, when we could rehearse them. But let's focus on the hopeful. And Sam, you're South African, and I'd like to just end with a thing I heard on a BBC radio program of Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, quoting Desmond Tutu. And I mean, so the two of them are doing this thing for the UN where they go and meet some of the hardest political cases, wars, people who end up in front of the criminal court in The Hague, and they're sitting down with these people. Mary Robinson talks about how Tutu would use humour as a tactical weapon. So he'd use humour to put these folk at their ease and then go in like a rapier with his point or his question. But also how he was accused by a journalist once, they were being interviewed together, of being naively optimistic. And he said, apparently, "Oh no, you misunderstand me completely. I'm not an optimist. I am a prisoner of hope." And I think a bit like kindness, you know, we can be in a more hopeful or a less hopeful context, but we do all have some element of choice in it. You know, Viktor Frankl, many others have shown that, even in the darkest places. So why wouldn't we want to choose to be hopeful?
James, that's such a wonderful way to end, and thank you for the South African reference. Yes, I think this idea of hope, and certainly what you've given our listeners today, is a kind of sense that these very human things, these working in small groups, building relationships, practicing kindness, actually have a huge impact. And even in a world in which everything wants to be measured and driven by data, it's the real human connection that counts. And of course, AI couldn't have had this joyous conversation in such a lovely way. So there's always going to be place for just the very human interaction, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank
And
you very
perhaps you
much
can
for
even
joining
discover
our
more
connect.
about our
Yes.
human. Sorry,
Please
sorry.
carry on.
Sorry. Well, I was just going to say, perhaps through the observation of what machines can do and can't, we can become more aware of what really does distinguish a human. And therefore, maybe paradoxically, through technology, we can discover more humanity.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I absolutely think so. And I just to end on the word matter, we've always said that our role is to help leaders do what matters most. I mean, we've spoken about the word matter today. So if we can leave every person listening to this is really asking the question to their employees, to people in their teams, you know, what matters to you? It would make our world a much better place. So thank you very much, James. For more information on the topics that James spoke about on this podcast, do go to the Harvard Business Review published in November 2020. The article is 10 Leadership Lessons from COVID Field Hospitals by Richard M.J. Bomer, Jeanette R. Ives Erickson, Greg S. Meyer, Bonnie B. Blanchfield, James Mountford, W. Cray van der Bachen, and Giles W. Boland.